O come, Emmanuel. Emmanuel literally means God is with us. And this carol says God is not only with us, also within us, dwelling as love, as truth, as light, as hope. When we as Unitarians and Unitarian Universalists speak of the divine spark within every person, it is, I think, this indwelling divinity we refer to comfort the exiles. And even further now, as the eighth principle claims, striving that no one be excluded, no one be in exile. To turn all hearts to peace, that greed and war shall cease. The vision of every broken soul made whole, the healing, and wisdom tempered with care. These are some of the values received from our Christian heritage, and yet it is so complicated for us. We find ourselves, I think, in the midst of a complicated season, and this year, so many added complications. And nowhere, I think, is Christmas more complicated than in a Unitarian congregation full of our different theologies. And so the question comes every December, why would a Unitarian celebrate Christmas? If we don't believe in the virgin birth, or that Jesus was God, or that he was born and died to redeem a sinful world, what business do we have with Christmas? It's a fair question. The answer, though, is that we have a lot to do with Christmas. In fact, the Unitarian tradition has had such a significant hand in shaping so much of what we know today as Christmas, that in some ways it begs asking just why Christians celebrate Christmas, given that it is so very Unitarian Universalist. At the outset, it's important to say that Christmas isn't what it once was. Down through time, it has changed and evolved, appropriating earlier traditions and morphing them into the mix of holiday and holy day that we have inherited in our own time. Such is what we do as Unitarians. Christmas itself wasn't celebrated in any meaningful way by Christians until the 4th or 5th century, and even back then, situating the birth of Jesus on December 25th was recognized as a pretty blatant piggybacking on the winter solstice. Not to mention the fact that December 25th was also the birthday of the invincible sun god Mithras, the Roman god with Hindu origins, who came to redeem the world from evil, and who also just happened to be born in a cave to a virgin mother. From the very beginning, the basic fact of what you might call Christian Christmas have never been entirely settled. And that's in large part because Christmas was built on the foundation of mostly pagan religions. And so there has seemingly always been an unresolved tension in the heart of Christmas, a tension, if you will, between piety and partying. By the time our religious forebears, the Puritans, came around, partying was winning out. Christmas in the English-speaking world was a time of merrymaking, a festival marked by people blowing off steam and flaunting social convention in a joyfully crude and rowdy ways. And at its most colorful, it involved cross-dressing, public lewdness, and role reversals of all kinds. Its central ritual involved the working poor calling upon the homes of the prosperous and expecting to be served the best food and alcohol in the house. Turning the class structure on its head, the wealthy on Christmas would serve those who normally serve them. All of this, a safety valve of sorts that maintained the status quo and the balance of power the other 364 days of the year. As you might imagine, the Puritans didn't care one bit for a day devoted to public debauchery, especially in the name of Jesus. In 1645, when the Puritan Oliver Cromwell came to power in England, he enforced an act of Parliament banning the celebration of Christmas. This was the case for 15 years. And on this side of the pond, in Massachusetts, at least south of the border, Christmas was banned from 1659 to 1681. I wasn't able to find such stats for Canada. Though there were such laws in place here, Christmas wasn't a big deal in Upper Canada either. There are accounts well into the 19th century that make it clear that Christmas was a workday for many people in this part of the world. At the same time, there was a growing desire for Christmas to mean something more, a hope that it could be reformed into a time of reverence and moderation. Stephen Nissenbaum, who has written a definitive history called The Battle for Christmas, says this, and I quote, "In the forefront of those leading this movement were Universalists, who openly celebrated Christmas from the earliest stages of their existence. And the Unitarians," he said, "were close behind. Compared with Universalists, Unitarians were more genteel for all their theological liberalism, more socially conservative. Unitarians were calling for the public observance of Christmas by about 1800. They did so in full knowledge that it was not a biblically sanctioned holiday and that December 25th was probably not the day on which Jesus was born. They wished to celebrate the holiday, not because God had ordered them to do so," Nissenbaum says, "but because they themselves wished to." So very Unitarian, right? He goes on to say that they celebrated in hope that their own observance might help to purge the holiday of its associations with seasonal excess and disorder. Seems to me we continue with this part of the battle. Early Universalists and Unitarians helped to lead a movement that transformed Christmas from a celebration that took place in the streets to one that unfolded primarily in the home. The presents that had once been demanded of the rich by the poor pretty quickly became the gifts given from parents to their children. Of course, it wasn't long before Santa Claus entered the scene. And though not tied to Unitarians, he brought an element of mystery to the family-centered Christmas and a convenient revisionist marketing triumph for retailers. A few years later, early Unitarians made one of their key contributions in the form of the Christmas tree. Though there are, of course, pagan origins to decorating a tree at the solstice, it was Charles Follen, a Unitarian minister, who brought the tradition from Germany to North America. At Christmas in 1835, Follen decorated a tree with fruit and toys and lit candles as a surprise for his children. His friend Maria Sedgwick wrote about it in a widely read book, and within a few years, the tradition had taken hold far and wide. Concerned with the growing commercialism of Christmas, though, and the prospect of their children becoming selfish and spoiled. Unitarians embraced a tradition of children exchanging gifts with their parents. The ritual became a way to teach a moral lesson about giving and receiving while enforcing and reinforcing the bonds of family. This is more than the introduction of the Christmas tree itself, may be one of the most enduring and unique ways that Unitarians have shaped the holiday. Nissenbaum goes on to say that child-rearing practices were linked to theological beliefs. I personally find this so fascinating. Whether parents choose to beat their children or lavish attention on them at Christmas was linked to whether they believed in original sin. The central tenet of early 19th century Unitarians, and one that distinguishes them from the old style Puritans, was the belief that human beings were not born or bound for damnation. Puritans and most evangelical Protestants at the time, in contrast, believed that people were inevitably stained at birth by original sin that corrupted them in their very core by causing them to be willful and selfish. Puritan-minded parents, therefore, felt that it was their obligation to break a child's will as early as possible. Unitarians, on the contrary, believed that the will should be trained rather than broken. It might be imperfect, they thought, but it was not fundamentally corrupt. Unitarians strenuously believed that human beings were responsible, utterly responsible, for their own actions. That belief figured into other significant shift rooted in Unitarian theology. The move beyond a Christmas solely celebrating the birth of Jesus to a season of charity and social outreach. This spirit is easily recognized in the classic work of Charles Dickens, again, another Unitarian. Written in 1843, A Christmas Carol derides the changing class structure and a society being rapidly reshaped by the Industrial Revolution. It challenges the notions of poverty somehow being a form of divine punishment rather than a social problem that must be solved. In a single compelling story, Dickens reinforced the central role of the family at Christmas, while also teaching lessons about charity, compassion, and human connection. Yet Dickens wasn't so much describing a tradition as creating one. One that resonates to this day as the larger context of our cultural Christmas. And finally, on this tromp through history, a couple of carols in our hymnal were written by Unitarians, both written as a response to the horrors of war, and both ultimately representing the choice of hope over despair. We will sing It Came Upon the Midnight Clear, written by Edmund Hamilton Sears in 1849, and I will share more about that shortly. While it's been sung throughout the world for a century and a half, many Christian churches have yanked it from their hymnals for what it doesn't say. Perhaps you notice that there's no mention of Jesus. He speaks instead of peace on earth, goodwill to all. And he speaks of the hard fact that the world has long resisted the call to the angel's song. And there is another in our hymnal as well. I heard the bells on Christmas Day. Henry Wadsworth's Longfellows wrote these words. And these two carols were radical for their day. In choosing the story of striving after peace and goodwill over the story of the Nativity, And I think these carols remain radical in our own day as well, asking how we contend with our despair, asking in what we place our deepest trust, asking how we invest our hope. Christmas is not what it once was. It is, like each of us, a work in progress. And so, if anyone asks why we would celebrate it, I would say because we can lay at least as much claim to Christmas as anyone else. This is our holiday, so celebrate it well. Make of it a season that brings joy into your heart and more peace into this world. Let us hold this in our hearts as we ponder and wander through this season. And let us now join our voices together in singing hymn number 244 in the gray hymnal, It Came Upon the Midnight Clear. That Christmas carol, It Came Upon the Midnight Clear. And it is the midnight clear. I always thought it was a midnight clear. Anyway, directs us to one of the gifts, our Christian heritage, that helps us answer the ethical question of who we are called to be and how the Christian heritage informs our faith today. It Came Upon the Midnight Clear was written on a cold December 25th in 1849, 170 years ago, by Edmund Hamilton Sears, a direct descendant of one of the original Pilgrim Fathers. He was a retiring Unitarian clergyman, scarred by the issues of slavery and the drumbeat of revolution in Europe and the Mexican-American War still fresh in his mind. Reverend Sears composed his poem while serving as a minister of the Unitarian Church in Wayland, Massachusetts. And a year later, he asked his good friend, Richard Willis, a distinguished editor and music critic for the New York Tribune, to write a flowing melody for his poem. What resulted is what we just sang, that glorious song of old, Peace on earth, goodwill to men from heaven's all-gracious King. The first significant carol with the social message of peace and goodwill, extended in those original words of the time to men and changed now in many places, including our UU hymnal, to goodwill to all. It Came Upon the Midnight Clear was, as I've already said, quite unusual for its day because most carols had the Nativity of Jesus centered. This focus instead on peace was in keeping with the Unitarian faith and its allowance for anti-war sentiments. Not the case for most faith traditions. Sears also served the first Unitarian parish in Weston, Massachusetts, and his original manuscript of the poem is preserved there in the children's chapel, the chapel that is named in honor of him. And an incredibly interesting fact that I think reflects our Unitarian grounding is that the Weston Church, there is a reliquary. Reliquaries are typically found in English churches and cathedrals where you might find the bones of a saint preserved and on display. The Weston Unitarian reliquary holds a book by Reverend Sears. So Unitarian, right? No bones of saints, instead, books. You'll also find there illustrated manuscripts of his two carols. This focus on peace and goodwill is a gift of our Christian Unitarian heritage. The Dictionary of Unitarian Universalist Biography records Sears to have said this: Jesus was neither a primary historical figure disappearing into the distant past, nor a subject for theological pugilism, but an experience in daily life. For seers, the example of Jesus' life of radical inclusion, justice, and peace can and needs to inform our daily living. And this is who Unitarians and Unitarian Universalists, I think, see Jesus as, an exemplar, someone whose life lived is a role model for how we might live. He certainly practiced the eighth principle that we have just affirmed. A few years after Sears wrote, "It Came Upon a Midnight Clear About Peace and Goodwill," in the year 1853, a British Anglican hymn writer, John Mason Neal, wrote the lyric of "Good King Wenceslas" that tells the story of a Bohemian king going on a journey and braving harsh winter weather to give alms to a poor peasant, accompanied by his page who is sustained in the quest by the example of the king's kindness. These two carols, I think, speak to the essence of the Christian heritage that informs our UU faith today, to work for peace in ourselves, our relationships, and the world, to practice and extend goodwill to all, and to give as generously as we are able. May it be so, and that is the segue to the offering.